Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This week on Meat & Three, we're revisiting kitchen joys to bring a bit of levity to life during lockdown.
The major lesson is that I'm learning to just enjoy anything that I can taste and to taste it slowly and to just enjoy it.
Reach for those jars of jam, you know, maybe bourbon, that apricot jam, and maybe some lemon juice. Shake it vigorously and strain it into a cocktail glass. It'll be delightful.
It's like, no, what are you cooking? What do you like to cook? And naturally, that's going to be a little bit like a niche because you are not going to be an expert at everything. Your shtick could be that you are not an expert at everything, but you want to learn.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Esther Kim is a writer and editor of the Asian American Writers Workshop's Trans-Pacific Literary Project. Today we'll be discussing Jumokbap, how this little fistful of rice fueled the South Korean Democratic Revolution and is now making a comeback, sustaining those on the COVID front lines. Welcome to the show, Esther.
Thanks so much for having me, Coral.
So where are you joining us today?
So I'm here in Long Island, New York, just 40 minutes outside of the city.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up there?
I did, yep. We made the sort of eastward migration from Bayside out to, Long Island, further mm-hmm. Long Island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for those who are unfamiliar with what, let's even just start with what the Asian American Writers Workshop is and then what the Trans-Pacific Literary Project is.
Sure. So the Asian American Writers Workshop is a wonderful organization, nonprofit organization that's based in Manhattan. And we host different kinds of events and fellowships for emerging and established Asian American writers. And one of the things that we do is we publish an online magazine known as The Margins and the Trans-Pacific Literary Project, which is a fairly recent part of The Margins magazine. So the Trans-Pacific Literary Project is what I edit. And the Trans-Pacific Literary Project is a platform for original and translated writing from Southeast and Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. And so, as I'm sure this has been on your mind as well, I feel like there's a lot of pressure to, you know, maybe create more content or create more thoughtful content during the month of May, which is Asian American and Pacific Heritage Month. And how do you navigate that?
It's a really excellent question. I just started with the Asian American Writers Workshop this April, actually. So it's been sort of, you know, like rapid fire learning how to move events onto Zoom and different online platforms. And then in terms of like trying to create Asian American content in the middle of the pandemic, there's been a lot of negotiating. Obviously, sort of the politics that have been happening with anti-Asian stuff that's happening. Recently, Jeffrey, and our executive editor, just worked with PEN America to issue a statement with 100 different Asian American writers standing against anti-Asian hostility, and that was out in The Guardian. So there's been different ways that we've been trying to answer to, you know, like celebrating the literature of Asian American writers, as well as the current pandemic and harassment stuff that's happening in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big project. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. So how would you define the genre of Asian American writing? I feel like that's also kind of a sticky, not too clear guideline also.
Yeah, definitely. I think because even Asian is a different, is a difficult thing to define. I think that what the Trans-Pacific Literary Project tries to do is highlight the Asian part. So since we're publishing a lot of translations from Asian languages, we're getting insight into what a lot of creative Asian writing looks like now, instead of the usual sort of like, I don't know, like snow fan and pandas and that kind of content, mm-hmm. I guess. And just seeing some of the really amazing, vibrant, creative stuff that's happening in cities around Asia. But yeah, I think that it is something that is hard to define, like whether it stretches from Central Asia to Oceania. And I think that's something that we're constantly interrogating with the Trans-Pacific Literary Project, like who can we include more of, who can we hear from more.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And so
would you say then that dividing Asian American or Asian literature into subgenres by generation is in fact too limiting?
Too limiting?
Right.
Is
that in a way kind of assigning a blanket experience to a generation? And is that something you are conscious of or try to avoid or, yeah.
I think that it's always sort of like the frame that you start off with in order to, start investigating bigger questions. Because, I mean, you don't want to completely delete the Asian from Asian American and just mm-hmm. say it's all American. But obviously, like, being aware of who is included or excluded from Asian label, and then also being aware that Asian includes like a really broad amount of experiences, Asian American, I mean. So like if you all of the sort of stats people like to disaggregate the data. So if you look at like the experience of somebody who's grown up Cambodian American, as opposed to say Taiwanese American, like that can be extremely different. So mm-hmm. yeah, I think that because we're doing a sort of literary analysis at the Asian American Writers Workshop, we get to hear a lot of individual perspectives and stories, and that kind of is our effort at getting past the statistics part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I ask because I feel like, especially this year, there's been a lot of backlash against what is known as like the stinky food genre of personal essay, which is, you know, common to a lot of first gen or second gen American immigrants. And I kind of took that to be a little sad or a little, I don't know, upsetting, because, you know, that is true to our experience and that is true, that is worth talking about. And so how do you move from here?
It's a good question. I actually had never heard of the label stinky food genre before. And then I was like, what does this mean? Like the like case against durian kind of essays? But then I realized that, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I was going to ask one more or add one more. Mm-hmm. Is that the, like, you know, the shame over hiding my lunch or hiding myself in that way? And yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think that there's a general sort of push against, for me, it's not like so much the stinky food essays as it is like personal essays. Like, I think that people, there's a like certain ceiling that people are reaching with the kind of mm-hmm. like introspective work that's happening in personal essay. And I think that it's really difficult to pull off well, because like you're trying to balance in an essay, like not only examining, say, like feelings and intense emotional feelings about how people are responding to your stinky lunch, but you're also talking about the stinky lunch itself, which is, you know, has like a really rich food history. But I think that like one example of a personal essay that I saw that I was like, this is so good, this is like a masterclass of how to do it, was Ishe Govindar's essay about eating with her hands. Mm-hmm. So she's a South African Indian writer, food writer. And in that essay, she talks about like the shame she grew up with eating with her hands, since traditionally in India you just eat with your hands. And then like in South Africa, that not being accepted in university, and then eventually marrying someone who's Dutch, and then her husband was really into like embracing this part of her culture, and then she was sort of mystified by it, but then eventually comes to this like re-embracing of that heritage. And there's also like a little bit of food history about how actually eating with your hands makes food taste better, like scientifically for some reason. So that was an example where I was like, this is really well done. Like, she's able to balance these kinds of two things that are important to a good personal essay.
Mm-hmm. So what are our responsibilities as Asian American writers to ourselves, to non-Asian readers, and to fellow Asian readers, you know, not only in the tale we tell, but also, I guess, the intended use or utility of our writing?
It's a really political question, I think. I think that as Asian American writers, we have feet in two places, right? So America and then whatever country of heritage our parents or grandparents or whoever came from. And then with that, we're able to talk about food because we have different memories of like what we eat as children, like different ways we're sitting at the kitchen table and how we are eating at the kitchen table. So I think that it's important to really represent that, obviously, but also just to like recognize not just the Asian American part, but also like the Asian part, because I think that when we're in Asian America, we kind of forget that we're able to speak in English with this American accent, and that gives us access to power and publications that other countries or say writers don't have that access to. So I think, yeah, it's just important to really pay attention to outside of mm-hmm. yeah, outside. Yeah.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Okay, so the reason we're here is actually not to talk about any of this, but actually to talk about Jumapop, which you did research on. So can you talk about, you know, what sparked that interest in the first place, what Jumapop is? Yeah, let's just start there.
Sure. Yes, this is like the meat of the how I got to, yeah, talk with you about, yeah, all this stuff. So Jumokbap is basically a Korean, like, snack, and it takes basic staples. It's rice balls, and it takes basic staples like cooked rice and salt. And if you want to get fancy, sesame oil, sesame seeds, and chopped seaweed. And that's mixed together in a bowl, and you shape it into a compact fist-sized ball. And that's how it gets its name. Jumok means fist, and pap means rice, so fist rice. Basically, I went to my mom's birthplace in South Korea. It's this city called Gwangju, and it's on the southwest side of Korea. And while I was there, I got to eat all of the really delicious food of the city. I learned while I was there that there's a pretty intense regionalism within Korean Peninsula between the West and the East, and the West is very proud of its food. And it's also very proud of its history in being part of the democratization movement in South Korea. So basically, I was researching how South Korea converted from this dictatorship from the 1980s into a democracy. It really hasn't been that long that it's been a democracy, and you still see a lot of the debates and sort of polarization politically within the country right now. And Jumokbap was kind of part of that food history / political history.
Mm-hmm. So how did it play a role?
Yeah, so basically I learned that one of the key flashpoints of the democratization movement was May 18th, 1980, or how Koreans remember it, which is 5/18. And it's the 40th anniversary of that event this year. And basically during the Gwangju uprising, 5/18, So the city of Gwangju was the center of this pro-democracy uprising, and it was a bunch of university students, workers who were protesting the authoritarian government at the time. And it was about a week-long siege that the U.S.-backed Korean forces placed upon the city in May 1980. And as a result of this siege, the official figures say that about 150 people were killed and more than 4,100 were wounded. But those are just the official figures that are provided by the military, and so it's a quite conservative estimate. There's other reports that say there's about 1,000 to 2,000 who died over the course of those weeks, or course of the week. And there's no, universally accepted number. And then during this protest, week-long protest movement, obviously these students who were on the front lines trying to protect their city and protest the regime had to be fed. And so this is how Jjumukbap plays a role. A lot of the marketplaces that were shut down during this time, the women just decided to band together and to just make these huge cauldrons full of rice. And they shaped them into these little balls, put some salt in. And then because they were tightly packed, they could just toss them into the oncoming trucks and cars that were driving by. And then these were meant to feed the front lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but it feels totally eerily similar to what's going on now, though we don't have, cauldrons of rice on the street. But, how might you explain food can play such a powerful role in, affecting change and unifying a community?
I think that, Jjumukbap is definitely a symbolic food for the city. And it's this sort of memory of a collective resistance. And I definitely do see the parallels with what's happening in New York City with the different charitable organizations that are trying to feed the front lines. The front lines here being different from the Korean ones, say, with the Korean ones being these university students who are protesting. And then the New York City ones, say, being the hospital workers and doctors and nurses. But I think that with all of this kind of symbiotic relationship that's happening, at least in New York City, where, there are COVID-19 units who are receiving these donations from restaurants that have closed for the first time in, say, decades and are trying to figure out what to do with their ingredients and their labor. They're able to donate this food and just feed people so that they can keep continuing to work and to protect or to nurse people back to health during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was definitely thinking of that, but I was also thinking of the anti-Black violence protests that are going on. And I almost, it takes me back to an essay you wrote about your boyfriend and kind of
being deep dive
internet stalking, but being kind of prickled by Eddie Huang. And I totally, totally can relate. Everything he does or did, or even when I think about Rush Hour, the series going back, it's really icky. And so can you actually, for our listeners who did not internet stalk you, explain what you discuss in the essay and how there's kind of this history of Asian Americans and Black kind of being on the same page, but not really?
Sure. Also, props to your research. Oh my gosh, I completely, I had written that essay back in, I think it was 2015. And that was when I was really wrestling with questions of like the Black Lives Matter movement was in full force at that point. And I was trying to figure out, Asian American identity, how does Asianness, yellowness, whatever you want to call it, fit into this American binary of white and Black? And where's, our place in the discussions right now? How do we show solidarity? And I did that by looking at Eddie Huang, who's the Taiwanese American chef, cook, business guy, who wrote Fresh Off the Boat and has that whole TV show thing. And then, so Eddie Huang and Claudia Rankine, who wrote poem called Citizen, and was really thinking about all of the people who had died from police brutality. Yeah. And so like, I start out the essay by basically talking about like how this ex-boyfriend is also at this book event for Eddie Huang, and then and the one thing I left out of the essay is that he's white, and I intentionally decided to leave that out. But he walked out of the event basically being disgusted by how Eddie Huang was trying to imitate or like appropriate blackness as part of his whole act. And yeah, that sort of sparked the essay.
Mm-hmm. And so did you leave the talk being surprised at your boyfriend's reaction, or were you also like, yeah, that's like, that's pretty messed up, and then kind of decided to look into that?
I think I was more on the first reaction. Mm-hmm. Like, I was annoyed that it was him who had to like decide, right? Like, as a white liberal who gets to decide. And at the same time, I was trying to figure out like what is okay to, yeah, like what is okay to imitate, and how do we, if we do, or borrow from or be influenced by, if we do, how do we do it in a way that celebrates and recognizes like the individual, like the difference, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, it's almost like your boyfriend's reaction only recognized two sides of the spectrum and did not know how to place the Asian American experience. And so it felt, you know, incorrect.
Yeah. And I went down this whole bunny hole where I started looking up like Afro Asia solidarities. Mm-hmm. Like, there was like, I think like African/African-Americans were in Indonesia for some conference back in like the 60s or 70s. Yeah. It started a whole thing where I was, yeah, trying to figure this out. Mm-hmm.
So back to Fistful of Rice. So this is really powerful because I feel like it's one of the few instances where, you know, all systems worked and did okay and ultimately yielded a great result. And so what do you think this might mean for our future of food?
I think that there's a lot of stuff that's happening right with food right now. I've been reading all of the articles in Food and Tech Connect, the newsletter, and thinking about the supply chain of food. I think that there's a lot of hope we can take, at least in the whole story of how Jumokbap, like just remembering the people, the women in the marketplace who banded together and were really fighting to feed the front lines. And that meant sometimes that was just like their children, and just like celebrating the fact that there are New Yorkers who are donating to these different organizations, and there are restaurants who are suddenly becoming grocery stores or just donating food to the front lines, as in the doctors and nurses. But I think that like for the future of food, I would say just read Michael Pollan's essay in the New York Review of Books, because he does talk about like the larger problems that we need to reckon with in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And which one is that?
The Michael Pollan essay is the most recent issue of the New York Review of Books. I think he just talks about like food supply. I can't remember the exact title, but he just recognizes that there's the U.S. food system is basically set up for, you know, cheap, fast food, which has kind of led to underpaying, say, migrant labor who are working at the crops, and also has led to, say, meat processing plants. Like, I read that one meat processing plant does like 80% of like cow meat or something. It just has like centralized things so much in the U.S. that like once, you know, there's a wrench in the system, then suddenly it's so clear why there's a shortage. Like, yeah. And so when there's things like farmers dumping milk or euthanizing chickens, like, why is that happening? And he answers those kinds of questions that don't really seem apparent when you're at the grocery store. Right.
That's a great listener homework thing to end on. Thank you so much for joining me today, Esther.
Thanks for having me, Coral.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.